If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Thursday, July the 12th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow. Our guest today in Hoover's recording studio, deep in the heart of the Stanford University campus in the shadow of the Hoover Tower, is Margaret Hoover. Margaret's last name is not a coincidence. She is the great-granddaughter of Herbert Hoover, the 31st President of the United States, this institution's founder, born on August 10th, 1874 in West Branch, Iowa. There's much more to Margaret Hoover than a famous last name. She is a sophisticated political thinker and a voice for bringing the GOP into the 21st century, appealing to younger voters. She's an advocate for equality. She's a published author, a most eloquent public speaker, and a commentator on CNN. And she is the host of The Reborn Firing Line, which is available on PBS affiliates across the nation. Margaret, thanks for coming on to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
Are you sick and tired of being asked if you're William F. Buckley?
No. It's easy to say no.
Does it come up in every interview about
Firing
Line?
But that's the obvious first question.
Right.
I mean, the obvious first question, so you're trying to be William F. Buckley? Nope. Okay. Nope, I'm not trying to be William F. Buckley,
okay.
Fortunately.
How do you differ from Mr. Buckley?
Everything about me is different from Mr. Buckley. I mean, at first sight, I think that is quite obvious, and I'm not going to try to be him. I mean, what William F. Buckley did and what he achieved was to bring a rigorous, lively, entertaining exchange of ideas to television. Mm-hmm. And that tradition really stopped and ended when he rolled up Firing Line in 1999 after 33 years on air, which was the longest tenure that any individual had hosted a single television program in television history.
Wow.
Which is so shocking that we don't sort of generally, the public doesn't know that. I think if you ask most people, they'd say it was Johnny Carson.
Or 60 Minutes or something like that. Yeah.
And they'd say, oh, Meet the Press has been going for 70 years, but not with a single host.
Different host, right.
Not with a single host. Bill Buckley was a different person when he started his program. He had just run this mayoral campaign where he had started the Conservative Party in New York City, which was just sort of an anathema, this concept that there would be a, frankly, conservatism could have an intellectual pedigree, let alone a political force behind it. And so he becomes this exponent of these ideas on a national level, but first locally and nationally to the extent that National Review was national at that point, although in the mid-60s it really didn't have much circulation. But his copy to reporters on street corners and impromptu press conferences when he was running for mayor was so rich and so good that it led to Firing Line, because people thought, we got to get this guy on television. And there were a couple of television producers who tried to pair him with big executives and television programs, and he, of course, had instead his first producer was a 22-year-old recent college graduate who ended up producing the show for the first 5 years before he went on to have Warren Stiebel produce the show for the next 28.
So we've now laid out the next 35 years of your life. If Buckley ran for mayor and then did 33 years on Firing Line, you'll do 30-plus years on Firing Line, and then as a New Yorker, you'll run for mayor in New York City.
Maybe. That's what I tell programmers, because programmers are very concerned about picking up Firing Line, not knowing whether it's going to be back in 26 weeks. And I've told them, well, you know, Buckley ran for 33 years. We're going to go for 34.
Outstanding. Margaret, I'm going to play Hoover genealogy with you.
And I love Hoover genealogy. Thank you for starting there. I just want to say thank you for starting there. I love talking about Herbert Hoover.
Okay.
And it makes me really, really excited because of his legacy. And everybody tells me they'll get to it eventually, and it's always the best part of the interview.
So let me see if I have this right. I spent some time trying to sleuth this together. If I didn't get it right, correct me, but here we go. February 10th, 1899, Herbert Hoover marries Lou Henry. And I believe they go to China the day after their wedding. They have two children. Herbert Charles Jr., born in 1903, and Allen, born in 1907. You're nodding your head, so far so good.
So far so good.
March 1937, Allen marries Margaret Coberly. That name sounds familiar, by the way. We'll get to that in a minute. They have three children. One daughter, she's the third child born, Lou Henry, born in 1943. She passes away in 2012. And two sons, Allen Jr., born in 1938, passes away in 2013. And Andrew, born in 1940. Andrew marries Gene
Andrew's
Williams.
Still alive, and he's my dad.
Yes. Andrew marries Gene Williams, and they produce Margaret Claire Hoover.
It's a lot of genealogy, but yes, that's exactly right.
And we're not going to say what year Margaret Claire Hoover was born.
No, she was born in 1977, and I'm 40 years old, and that's the exact same age that Buckley started Firing Line.
So that's the tree. So a couple things about this, Margaret. Margaret Coberly Hoover, who would have lived nearby in Portola Valley, right? Right, residence nearby. This is Star Trek. She lives long as she prospers. She lives to be 98 years old. She's married for 56 years. She's active in Republican politics.
A little bit, yeah.
Sounds a bit like grandmother, granddaughter.
Well, I have a very strong lineage of women and women in the Hoover family. It's starting with Lou Henry Hoover and my grandmother, for whom I am named. Mm-hmm. And she was a homemaker, a very proud homemaker. I mean, she had three children. Two of them were severely disabled, and so she had her hands full. Also, at a time when she was the daughter-in-law of the most reviled president in 20th century history or 20th century politics, and they're in like the top three list in American history of the most reviled president, especially when you're in the 20th century. I mean, many people, if you're a Republican, you're familiar with the Hoover Institution and Herbert Hoover's story. This might sound more familiar, but many people don't realize, you know, Herbert Hoover's name is still a synonym for economic hard times and is still used as a pejorative in our contemporary parlance.
Hoover flag, Hoover blanket, things like that.
Hoovervilles, Hoover. But that was because of an intense partisan effort on behalf of Franklin Roosevelt and the Democrats during the Great Depression, frankly, because their policies, New Deal policies, weren't sufficient to pull us out of the Great Depression. Right. And there was a long sort of ripple effect or tail to that that really affected and impacted the Hoover family in terms of how they lived their lives. And so my grandmother wasn't sort of an active in the forefront of politics because she was a Hoover and it was very difficult and her father-in-law was still alive. And, and the job and the responsibility of the family was to look after my great-grandfather, to help protect and rehabilitate his legacy, which was one of extraordinary and unparalleled human accomplishment, and that is a very big thing to say, and it is incredibly, absolutely true. Herbert Hoover, for his humanitarian work in Europe alone, would have been among the most famous and, I think, highly praised and respected individuals of the 20th century. His mining engineering feats and accomplishments before that had risen him and helped bring him to international prominence, and then his statesmanship after the presidency created a template for the modern post-presidency. And then he was also president. So he had, as my father used to always say, you know, four specific areas of his life, all of which by themselves might have earned him international distinction and prominence, and he had sort of four of them together. Any one of those, I'm happy to go down a bunny hole on, because it's an extraordinary American story that so many people have been deprived of because of the partisan nature of his successor and needing to remain in power and have credit for trying to fix the economy.
You're part of a rather unique club in America, and this is the Presidential Descendants Club. You go back to Kennedy, Margaret. Each president since Kennedy has a living child, a living offspring. But then you go further back to Eisenhower, Roosevelt, and Hoover, and so forth. The children are no longer with us. You're looking into granddaughters, great-granddaughters, and so forth. Not that the group gets together and you meet and you have secret handshakes or anything, but do you talk to the other offspring often? Are you friends with, for example, Chelsea Clinton is also a New Yorker. Do you talk to Chelsea at all?
No, so there's a great, this is actually great. So I've met Chelsea, but only because we're in a very similar cohort, and so we have similar friends. There's a real cutoff, I think, between the experience of a child of a president and the grandchild of a president and then the great-grandchild of a president. Yeah. And so the ones that I've really gotten to know well and really adore and love are the Johnson daughters. Because also as the further down the further past the presidency you are, and the more in the family business of family legacy and helping to secure, because we have these legacy contributions that the federal government has given us all, which are these presidential libraries. And so through the presidential library system, which, by the way, wherever you are, if you're listening to this, you are probably in a state that has a presidential library or has one close to you, and you should go visit them because they are a fantastic system. It is the one place in history where you go to get the president's side of the story. historians will determine, you know, there's a consensus of historians who will determine what the mainstream narrative is about that president. But if you right. want the president's side of the story, you go to that presidential library and you get mm-hmm. to see how that president wanted their story told. And it is up to those the president's children and grandchildren and inheritors of that legacy to continue to tell that story. And so that's where I am involved in the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library, which is in West Branch, Iowa. Herbert Hoover, of course, first had his papers right. here at Stanford University and then took them to West Branch, Iowa, which was the place where he had reacquired the cottage, the two-bedroom cottage that was less than 400 square feet that he was born in. Right. And it is also where he is buried. And so through the presidential library system, I've gotten to know Lyndon Baines Johnson's daughters and the Nixon family, as well as many members of the Nixon family, actually, as well as I did know a little bit of the Bush family because I had worked in the Bush White House. Mm-hmm. Clifton Truman Daniel is a great voice and representative for his grandfather Harry Truman's legacy. And the Fords, also Susan Ford, I've gotten to know.
Clifton is Margaret's son.
Son, exactly. So Margaret Clifton, exactly, or Margaret Truman, who was a brilliant musician and also an author, a novelist.
Yes.
And her husband had been the editor of the New York Times, and Clifton grew up in New York, and so I've gotten to know Clifton. So there is I think once you get really watered down in the food chain, there is a sincere cohort of individuals who are connected to a person who was important in American history, but have also self-selected in to choose to be part of that legacy and to help carry it forward. Because there are many other great-grandchildren of Herbert Hoover,
right.
And there are maybe three or four of us who are really excited about it. Mm-hmm. And so you do kind of self-select in if it animates you.
So you get in front of an audience, Margaret, and you have 30 minutes to explain Herbert Hoover to them. What is the takeaway that you want them to have? What is the one point that you want to make that you want them to take home?
That what you think you know about Herbert Hoover doesn't do justice to an extraordinary American hero and figure. And sadly, that part of the reason of that is because of the partisanship and the hyper-partisanship and polarization in our politics, which mm-hmm. didn't start yesterday. It actually didn't even start during the Great Depression. It has been with us since the beginning of our history. You had mm-hmm. partisan newspapers writing really horrific things about Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton and the Founding Fathers. So there is this tradition, but that tradition it tends to sort itself out over time, and it's about time that Herbert Hoover's legacy gets sorted out. And in that legacy piece, there is an unparalleled contribution to humanitarian work that Hoover pioneered, first as a private individual at the beginning of World War I, and I tell the story of Belgium, because Hoover was a private citizen running a consulting firm that was situated in London because it was the capital of mining finance, and he was an international businessman. Of international repute because of his work in the field of engineering and mining. And at the outbreak of World War I, he was 40 years old. See, 40 is the key number here. Being 40 is the best year on earth, everybody tells me. But actually, it was a terrible year. It was 1914.
Right.
And as a private businessman, Hoover recognized that he was in the unique position to be able to administer food relief to an entire nation that faced imminent starvation. And in the development and the organization of the Commission for the Relief of Belgium, which he and some of his partners put together as an LLC, for which they individually were financially on the hook for,
right.
they were able to administer food relief to 8 million Belgians within the first 2 months of the war, delivering 80,000 tons of food to Belgium and communities in northern France caught on the wrong side of the lines mm-hmm. for every month after the war, after 1914 in December. And this model for humanitarian food relief administered at such a large level, had never been done before, was extraordinarily complicated, and became the model for successful humanitarian relief projects afterwards, so much so that one of the staffers that volunteered for Hoover during that time was a man by the name of Maurice Pate. And Maurice Pate went on to, through his efforts of founding UNICEF, win the Nobel Peace Prize for UNICEF. So a model was developed here. We never ask now when we have humanitarian food crises around the world in different places, what are we doing about it? Because there are international organizations and nonprofit organizations around the world flooding to meet the needs of humans in crisis. But Hoover pioneered the model for doing that on the largest scale ever at the beginning of World War I. And there's so much more I could say about that, but that's one of the first and most important pieces to Hoover's story, because it was because of those efforts as a private citizen that he catapulted to international prominence, even beyond sort of his recognition in his field of engineering at the outbreak of World War I. And he became this indispensable man in Europe for Wilson during the Treaty of Versailles conference, and for every major player during World War I, because Hoover was able, the only individual to cross on both sides of the lines throughout the course of the conflict, because he was, and negotiate with warring powers, and he had his own, you know, powers of immunity. He watched the Battle of the Somme from a German outpost. He just had a really key and unique insight into the conflict and the individuals who were leading on either side of the war. And he also there began the collection that became the heart of the Hoover Institution, the Hoover War Library. Because he wanted humanity to learn the lessons from that conflict.
Can you briefly explain his relationship with Harry Truman, likewise a son of the Midwest? Truman's important because Truman is at the dedication for the library, right?
Truman, no. I mean, there's so much to say about Harry Truman. I am personally indebted to Harry Truman because Hoover, first of all, one thing I want to say about the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. When the Great Depression hit in 1930, the New York Times, right after the stock market crashes in 1929, 6 or 8 months into 1930, the New York Times editorializes that, thank God, you know, the tide has been arrested. Thank God Herbert Hoover was there. He was the most able man to have been in the presidency at the time of this crisis because of his knowledge of international economics, and none of his predecessors could have done as well as he did.
Right.
So there is this sense that Hoover has arrested the crisis, and then that ends up not being true,
right.
And the economy ends up, the global economy and global financial system comes to the brink, and Hoover leaves office, as we know, reviled. And Hoover is really sent into the wilderness and kept there by FDR and his successor and political forces that I think beneath the American character and spirit. And that was incredibly painful for him, especially at a time when World War II was ending up and there were humanitarian crises and food crises around the world, and Hoover was uniquely positioned to meet the needs of starving populations at the end of a war. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of occasions, there are fabulous quotes that illustrate how personally vindictive FDR was to Herbert Hoover. Many of his advisors advised him to reach out to Hoover because he was going to need his expertise at the end of World War II, and FDR has this quote that he would not be Jesus Christ and raise Herbert Hoover from the dead. So it was personal between the two of them, and they had been friends earlier in their lives or in their political careers. They had been friendly, at least. But it was Harry Truman, 5 days into the presidency, who personally wrote a letter to Herbert Hoover, had to convince his steward to go off of White House grounds to mail it in a mailbox because White House staff also believed, they were holdovers from FDR, they believed, you know, Hoover's toxic, you can't reach out to him.
Good heavens.
So Harry Truman is the individual who had the decency to see past the real indignities that Hoover had suffered at the hands of FDR because of his profession and the personalization of the politics and the Great Depression to Hoover, and write him a note. And the note said, and it's a beautiful note, and it's handwritten, and it's short, and it essentially said, I am going to need your expertise in the humanitarian crisis following the war, and it would be my pleasure to become acquainted with you.
Right.
And within 48 hours, Hoover is in the Oval Office, and he actually has this moment that is written about and not well known, where he is. It's an enormously powerful moment because he becomes overcome emotionally, and once he gathers himself, he and Truman have a long, extended visit of about 70 minutes, and Hoover is just so grateful to have been brought back into the fold, and then Truman dispatches him to make a tour of the world on a plane to visit 70 countries to assess the food situation, and then gives Hoover an opportunity to return to serve his country. And that gave Hoover meaning and purpose in his life after a period of 12 years of exile. Mm-hmm. And it was a utterly dignified and a beautiful gesture on behalf of the Trumans, for which the Hoovers are eternally grateful. And that is really the beginning of the friendship of me and Clifton Truman Daniel as well, because their friendship, they became close friends by the end of Hoover's life. They were Harry Truman and Herbert Hoover considered themselves best friends, and they were part of this President's Club because there were only two past presidents living, and they were the only two people who really understood the burdens of leading the free world. And it just really became this beautiful friendship where Hoover always said, "My closest friends are Democrats."
We have extra microphones in the studio, Margaret. If President Hoover were with us this morning, forget what I would ask him. What would you like to ask him as his great-granddaughter and somebody who's studied his life and his legacy?
I'd want some of the stories from World War I. Mm. I mean, I think some of the stories from World War I are extraordinary. There are a lot of stories from the Boxer Rebellion. Mm. There's a new biography out by Ken White, a single-volume biography, the first that has been published in maybe more than 20 years, I think, since Richard Norton Smith's. And there are some very interesting and colorful stories about his time in China in that accounting that have been pretty well documented by legal documents in London. I have a lot of questions about that time in his life, but I think I understand it. And he speaks very sweetly and fondly of his wife, Lou Henry Hoover, who he lost when in 1944. When she was 74, he lived another 20 years after that.
Right.
Oh, she was 70 years old. I'd like to hear him talk about their relationship because they had a really strong and powerful partnership. Mm-hmm. I'd like to hear what it was like during the Great Depression in the White House. I mean, he worked 16-hour days toiling away trying to fix it all. And I think now with the understanding of modern macroeconomic politics and theory, which we didn't have then, I think there was this thought that fiscally they could contain it, but they didn't have a sense of how monetary policy was affecting it. They thought they were in this inflationary period. It turned out they were in a deflationary period.
Right.
So the Fed was operating in a way that wasn't consistent with the fiscal policies and made it worse. I'd like to know what they were thinking. We have some sense of what he was thinking, but there's a personal side to Herbert Hoover that nobody saw because he was an orphan.
Mm-hmm.
He had this, you suffer this tragedy as a six-year-old where you lose your mother, or you lose your mother first, and then you lose your father. And, it made him appear to the world that he was an insensitive and not compassionate person, but it was actually that he was deeply scarred and, I think, emotionally damaged from having suffered such a experience. He then was sent west to live with, estranged relatives in Oregon. And you can go visit the house that he grew up in, but he had a little hatch under a staircase that was, quote-unquote, his room. And there
right.
was a pretty harsh uncle who ran the roost there. So he never talks about that period of his life. And you can see how a very young child might be deeply scarred by those things. And so I think there's a softer side of Hoover that came out in his later years that his research assistants, some of whom are alive, who worked with him in the Waldorf Astoria, one of them who's involved here at the Hoover Institution, a woman named Marie Louise Platt, has extraordinary stories of his kindness and generosity to her on a personal level. And I think he was able to soften in his later years, but not many people got to see that.
Interesting. Margaret, I watch a lot of book TV. I'm a nerd, and on the weekends I watch a lot of C-SPAN book TV. And
C-SPAN's my favorite channel,
yes.
So don't tell PBS
well,
or CNN.
I write a lot, and so it's great background
stuff
to have.
I love book TV.
I'm always kind of amused when an author comes on and they've written about George Washington or Thomas Jefferson or one of the founding fathers, and the questioner asks the obligatory, what would they make of these modern times? And part of me thinks, well, it's an interesting question, but it also, these are people who lived hundreds of years ago, and they probably just would not understand the world we live in right now. Herbert Hoover, on the other hand, passed away in 1964. So 54 years ago, so he would understand modern politics to a sense. If you asked him about what's going on today, particularly in his Republican Party, what do you think he would think?
He certainly saw the forces of populism ebb and flow throughout the course of his life.
His last year on the planet would have been the Goldwater year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Goldwater.
Right.
Goldwater made a big show at the end of the campaign of flying to Herbert Hoover's funeral.
Okay.
And connecting his legacy to Hoover's tradition.
Right.
But Hoover survived JFK. I mean,
Right. And he would have lived through the times of Huey Long and so forth.
I think he would have understood the sort of the economic challenges, the swells of populism, the responses on the left and the right. I mean, frankly, socialism seems ascendant again, but it was certainly even more ascendant in the years. I mean, Eugene Debs ran for president 6 times as a communist or as a socialist. So I think some of this would be very familiar to him. I think the larger trends in our history, right? It is cyclical, our economy
right.
and economics. In terms of the personality in the White House, there are there are sure signs that Hoover would be uncomfortable with some of the behavior in the White House. I mean, Hoover was a very buttoned up, proper, compassionate, and he was a Quaker. And his childhood was formed by sitting for 3 hours in silence in Quaker meeting. That's a lot of discipline that is imposed on a young child,
especially
a boy of 6 years old. And so he was an incredibly disciplined and focused and industrious person. And so those character traits were character traits that he valued in the presidency. He even ribbed Harry Truman for taking too much time fishing in Florida while he was president. So I think, you know, I think there are personal traits of the current occupant of the White House that he would have a hard time relating to, just because Hoover really prided himself on propriety and respect for the office.
Let's shift in the few minutes we have left from Herbert Hoover to Margaret Hoover. Your very good book, American Individualism, Margaret, there's a chapter entitled, quote, "How a New Generation of Conservatives Can Save the Republican Party."
I stand by every word I wrote, and it's totally overtaken by events.
So, to quote Ricky Ricardo, what happened?
What happened is right. What happened was, I stand by every word I wrote. It was right. That is the formula. And we didn't do it. The party didn't do it. The party went in another direction. And that's fine. In the short term, it's actually worked electorally. Mm-hmm. And I think it's still not a long-term solution for the country and for the party. I still think we have to reach out beyond white working class voters and the base of the Republican Party, and especially the emboldened base of the Republican Party, which has brought us to electoral winning. and that's certainly the direction. The party has shifted exactly away from the ideas that I articulated in that book. Mm-hmm. And I think the ideas in that book are correct. And I think the direction the party is going in is not a long-term solution. But it is a winning formula for the moment. And I have a lot of concerns about, I have an entire chapter in there about immigration and how I think we should approach immigration and reform. And it's exactly the opposite direction that our party's going in now. And that's a great concern to me. I'm also quite concerned, frankly, about what seems to be an abdication of concern about fiscal discipline on the right. Entitlements and the major sources of mandatory funding in our budget every year were a key component of sort of the conservative solution to long-term fiscal sustainability. And the party seems to have abdicated that priority as well. And so I have concerns about the direction we're going in. On the other hand, everybody says, we're winning! Right. And I worry about winning at the cost of, I think, principles that are right for the country.
So that's a nice segue to Firing Line, because you had Speaker Ryan on as a guest on Firing Line.
Speaker Ryan was my first guest. I was indebted to him for coming on and being the first guest on Firing Line. He also, when we aired the program nationally, he was the first guest nationally. The program is now on. Wherever you're hearing this, you can see the program in 90% of the country. So your local PBS station will have it. It's on 165 markets.
Here in San Francisco, it's on KQED on Friday nights and Saturdays.
Yes, and that's the great part. It re-airs, too.
Yes.
So if you miss it on Friday, you can catch it some other time through the weekend.
Also, also a device called the DVR.
Yeah, DVR it. That's true.
The Firing Line, the brand for Firing Line, quote, "a civil and engaging contest of ideas among the brightest minds and voices from across the ideological spectrum." Yes, Paul Ryan applies. Margaret, that's a heavy lift in what is kind of a bread and circus society that we live in right now.
Yeah, and some people don't want to come on because they don't want to actually talk about serious ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And some people do want to come on to talk about serious ideas and aren't as strong at it.
Who's on your bucket list?
Well, I'll tell you who I had this week, which was so great, was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Okay. You know, and I was coming over to campus, I was thinking that'd be a very good get for her because it's your sweet spot. It's millennial politics. It's the question of where this country is going. And just also to ask her, what do you stand for? What do you think is happening here?
We talked about democratic socialism, and it's amazing because the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA,
right,
is actually the inheritor organization to the organization that Michael Harrington started, which was also a democratic socialist organization in America that morphed into DSA. And they sponsored her. They supported her candidacy. And Michael Harrington was William F. Buckley's first guest on Firing Line.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this sort of debate about poverty and socialism. And so it's what we do in Firing Line is we always show our version of Firing Line, we always show an original clip from the original Firing Line, because part of this is to have a rigorous contest of ideas and exchange of ideas on television. Most people for deep content nowadays don't turn on cable news. Because you don't, it's hard to get a deep dive and a real exchange of ideas on television. So you go to podcasts, or you go to radio, or you go other places. And we're trying to return this tradition to public television. We're privately funded, I should mention. And so Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, to her great credit, came on and we talked about democratic socialism with Paul Ryan. We talked about poverty with a good friend of mine, Jamie Kirchick. Mm-hmm. We talked about free speech on campus with Gretchen Carlson. We talked about the Me Too movement and actually really the larger trend and theme there was, you know, changing culture and changing politics, and which comes first, the chicken or the egg.
Right.
And there are, let's see, who's on the, Jordan Peterson is scheduled to come in 2 weeks.
You had Kasich on the show.
I had Governor Kasich on the program. Mm-hmm. So who's on the bucket list? There's some big ones that I really hope to get, but I don't want to say it because I don't want to jinx it.
Yes.
But we're working on them. And it will be a cross-reference of cultural figures and political figures, electeds, appointeds, because I think the vein of Firing Line, the tradition of Firing Line, was anybody who is influencing our culture or our politics or our public debates or discourse and the way we sort of think about ourselves as Americans in the 20th century was Buckley's approach, and now we're in the 21st century. So it is not limited only to politicians.
And Buckley would sometimes have two or more guests on at the same time and let them exchange ideas, go back and forth from each other. Are you going to ever do that, or are you just going to do one?
He also had a great debate format too, which was wonderful. I loved the debate.
Yes.
I would like to get there. We're we're a startup operation, so we haven't done that format yet because we're still working out the kinks in our sort of in our newest iteration. I think the competitive advantage we have is that you can do one-on-one in-depth the way you and I are here on television, and there's not many other places on television where you can do that.
Right.
But I would like to introduce the debates, to reintroduce the debates. I think they're fantastic. But there are other places who are doing debates. IQ Squared does debates, so we sort of have to think through, maybe we do a Firing Line IQ Squared debate. I'm not opposed to it at all. We just have to sort of slowly but surely get there, and we're still new. Only 6 shows have aired.
Final question, Margaret. I'm going to dub you the all-knowing, all-powerful for one day and give you the authority to improve political discourse in this country. Tell me, how do you do it? You shut down Twitter? Do you ban cable television? Do you create a swear jar for politicians? How do you remedy the situation we're in right now?
Well, so if I'm all-knowing...
And all-powerful. Yes.
That gives me extraordinary power to control other people or to at least have other people ask themselves, here's the problem in our politics. I think, especially when we get online, but generally we don't assume best intentions from the people that we're engaging with, or we don't engage with people that we disagree with.
Right.
And this is something I've learned in my marriage because my husband and I don't agree on politics much of the time. But you have to at least assume that you can't even engage, we're not going to get anywhere, if you don't trust that the person who's coming to the table to engage with you in an argument is coming there because they care also, and that you want what's best for the country.
Right.
And if we could elevate and remind ourselves all, because I'm all-knowing and all-powerful, I would have this ability to impart on everyone that the person they're engaging with, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's on Facebook, whether it's across the table from a podcast, whether it's a person they're listening to in the car, that those people are speaking because they care about the future of the country first, then it humanizes them a little bit. And it's like, I think it's that we've lost this level of humanity in our discourse, that we've allowed ourselves to dehumanize our opponents, that allows us then to go off the rails.
Okay. Margaret Hoover, thanks for coming on the podcast. Congratulations on Firing Line. It's a hit.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. In this case, a look back at the 31st President, Herbert Hoover, courtesy of Margaret Hoover. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellowship to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Margaret Hoover is on Twitter. Her Twitter handle is, curiously enough, @MargaretHoover. And Firing Line is on Twitter, and its Twitter handle is @FiringLineShow. That is @FiringLineShow. How many markets is in the firing line in right now, Margaret?
165.
Wow. And you can find it. You can find it on your local listings. You can find it on PBS.org, right?
Exactly. Anything. If you happen to be in some small 10% pocket of the country that doesn't have it on your local PBS station, you can get it online and stream all of our shows.
So there you have it. Watch your show. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Thanks for listening, and happy birthday, President Hoover.
This podcast is a production of the Hoover Institution. For more podcasts and ideas from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org.